Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here this evening. Tonight, we are going to be talking about healthcare, challenges, issues, problems. We all know they exist. What do you do when someone is in the hospital, is in a nursing home, in hospice, and something comes up and you say, I am just getting a funny feeling. That does not feel right to me. Do you just wait? Do you complain? Do you yell and scream? Do you sit back? Or do you take an active stance in the care of your loved ones? What is it truly about? Do you going to get kicked out of the place? Are you going to no longer have health care? Yes, these are all possibilities. And we know that the circle in health care goes round and round. And I can't always say it's always good. There are many great things with health care. It's there to be able to help us, to take care of issues that we have, to help extend our life, and get us through a lot of crises that affect our physical body. However, many times we say this path just doesn't feel right. It seems to go awry. That's what we'll be talking about today, is a path that went down the wrong way. My guest today is Gloria York. Her book is Medical Manslaughter, based on a true story, Will Your Doctor Cause Your Death? Gloria, thank you so much for joining us today. It's such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Dr. Jeanette. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also, Gloria, I think sometimes your book, being based on a true story of you and your husband, helping your husband through his health crisis, I think it truly is a time where we say, is health care better these days, or is it truly going down the tubes and we need to start taking an active role? Yes?
Oh, absolutely. We have to assume responsibility for our own well-being. Gone are the days when the doctor had so much time to come in and spend with us and talk maybe 20 minutes, a half hour, ask about the family. Those days are gone. They are really only have maybe 5 to 10 minutes, if that, and they check what they have to. And if you don't ask any questions, then, of course, you'll never get any answers. So as with my husband's case, he collapsed at home, hit his head 3 times, had blood all over his brain and inside of his brain, but he had his senses about him. He knew me. He knew what was happening. He just had severe head pain, went into intensive care for 3 days, and then the blood started to go back in the body. So the doctor said, I'm going to send you to a regular floor. You'll have rehab starting tomorrow, and you'll be home in about 3 days. You're doing great. No major problems have occurred. But unfortunately, when he was up on that floor, he was tested by rehab. They said, we'll get you tomorrow morning. He fell asleep. In walks a doctor, assuming his chart. And she said, I'm going to change a lot of his medicines. I kind of questioned that a little bit. But also she said, tonight I'm giving him a sleeping pill. And I said, a sleeping pill, doctor? I said, is that his chart in your hand? Yes. I said, well, did you read it? Because three days ago, he hit his head and had a concussion and all, and I don't think he needs a sleeping pill. He's been sleeping fine these last few days in the hospital, and as you can see, he's sleeping right now. So back and forth we went, and then she became very belligerent and said, I know what I'm doing. And she stormed out of the room. And against my wishes, as I said during the day to the various nurses, I don't want him to have that sleeping pill. I don't want him to have it. And he normally got his pills at 10 o'clock. Well, when I left that evening, I went looking for the nurses around 7:30, and they had all gone to dinner. There was not a nurse on the entire floor. So I thought I still had time to call again and say again, no sleeping pill. But as I walked into the house, the phone was ringing. It was my husband. He said, I'm just checking to see if you got home okay. I said, yeah, great, honey, which was normal for him. And I said, how did you dial the phone? And he said, oh, the nurse is here. She dialed it for me. I said, great, put her on. So I said, listen, As I said earlier, I don't want him to have this sleeping pill. I'm the wife. And she said, well, too late. I already gave it to him. And
oh,
I said, no. You know, he don't get them till 10 o'clock at night. And she said, I decided to give it to him early. And Dr. Jeanette, when I walked in the next morning early, he was already in a coma.
You know, Gloria, I think right there is a good place to start with the conversation, because so many times we have doctors that, number one, I know I've said this before, I've even myself, a doctor, I don't write that on my chart. You know, when I go in, I'm just a person coming in for a visit. And I would say to them, the other doctor would walk in and she would have a piece of paper in her hand and say something to me. And I said, where's my chart? She says, oh, I just need to give you the test results. And she'd start telling me something. And I said, did you read my chart? She said, no, I don't need to read your chart. I'm only giving you test results. And I said, well, I suggest you go out and you read my chart. And she never came back in. So I think, you know, right there is something that's so vitally important, because reading charts is a very extensive process. I know for myself, having done it, is that when you're reading charts, there's a lot of information, a lot of other people's have put in input, and there's so much in a chart that you're saying, you know, I could spend a half an hour to an hour reading a chart to be able to spend 5 minutes with a patient. So a lot of times when you ask that question, the answer could be, is it really truth or not? Did they or did they not read the chart? And did they or did they not just read the last sentence of the chart? And I think in your case, definitely you never know what had transpired. However, when you started raising a bell about her reading the chart or being saying something, that really raises a lot of red flags. It's almost like it puts a target on your back, don't you think?
Yes, it's a fine line in correcting them and watching over them. It's a fine line you walk, because you certainly don't want them to get to the point where all of a sudden when you leave, they either cause harm or ignore, you know, your loved one. And so though you have to be attentive and be smart and ask good questions and be ready, you still, I always, of course, am respectful, and you have to be. But that doesn't mean that you have to just lay there as the patient or sit there as the advocate and accept everything that's being said. And it's good to question. There's no such thing as a bad question or a dumb question.
And also, too, to be able to speak up is actually the first thing. Next thing would be is to be present. You were there. You were in the hospital, because a lot of times people will leave them at the hospital and they think that they are safe. They're in someone else's care. The care is monitored. The care is checked. Everything is good, hunky-dory. And so many times I will say to people, it's truly up to you. That hospital is really just almost like you're just pulling into a place to rest, but it's really up to you to be able to keep an eye on the general plan of the health versus just each person doing their little piece. Don't you think sometimes in the care of your husband, each person had their own little piece, but you never saw general care unless you were looking over the whole puzzle?
Absolutely. And I stress this in medical manslaughter. I stress that you need to choose an advocate, and you should choose an advocate while you're healthy. And around the holiday time, when everyone's around the table or visiting or whatever, you should choose. And not, especially if you're a senior, you don't have to choose just one. You could choose two or three, because you're going to ask those advocates, will you come and visit me every single day? And will you spend about 4 to 5 hours with me and check me and talk to the nurse that is attending mm-hmm. to me that day, and also see the doctor face to face at least once every 5 days. And so you have to find out when he makes his rounds, and if they say 7 a.m., then you get there at 6 because it's just going mm-hmm. to be touch and go. But you got to make sure that the doctor knows you want to talk to them. And prior to talking, naturally, you get all your questions down on a piece of paper so that your everything is answered, like how's he doing? And if a surgery is recommended, well, what are some of the negative things that could go wrong? And naturally, there's no such thing as, an easy surgery. But you're trying to find out any of the negative aspects of what could go wrong and how long is it going to take him to heal? When do you think he could come home? And naturally, you're looking at these medicines they give because, as in medical manslaughter, I had to pull the port out of my husband's arm when all of a sudden I came to visit one day and I happened to be reading this paper that was laid there. And it said, do not administer to anyone with tinnitus, ringing in the ears. Mm-hmm. And he had that, and it was on his chart. He had that. And I went running out to look for a nurse. There was no nurse to be found, so I ran back in, pulled it out myself. And when I did, then an alarm went off. The sad part is the 1,000 megs already had gone in him. And the nurse mm-hmm. said, what are you doing? And I said, he is not to get this. Who prescribed this? He's allergic to this. And so then, he'll never get it again. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you. It's a full-time job to be an advocate, and you're right. Someone's got to be there. And it's important because if they see the nursing staff, even the doctors, if they see you don't have anyone visiting you, then they can ignore you while they take care of other patients because they figure, who are you going to complain to? Nobody seems to care about you. Nobody comes and visits you. So, you're not going to be able to complain to anybody. And I saw this not only in the hospital, but I saw this more so even in the nursing home.
Right. We see that quite often. A lot of times people will think that a nursing home is truly, a great place for someone to be because there's a lot of people around and a lot of eyes that would help you, when really a nursing home is pretty much just, a room to rent, rather a bed, actually, not even a room. It's a bed to rent, and, you can have food delivered that's generally whatever that is, and, you have pretty much basic minimal care. So many times now we see people trying to take care of healthcare themselves. They'll say, I'll become the advocate. While I think that family members absolutely should be the primary advocate, it's sometimes always good to have a secondary advocate, that you have a buffer, that you have a backup, you have someone to ask questions, you have someone to say, I saw this, where do I find the answers? I need to look this up, how do I do that? Or can we do a trade-off, a day here, 5 days there? And I think sometimes it's really important to be able to say, have these templates in place before they're needed, yes?
Oh, absolutely. And when you're finished reading medical manslaughter, you have so much more knowledge and the fortitude, you have the strength and the backbone to know that, hey, I'm the patient, I'm the advocate, and I have a right to ask questions and to have concern for this person's care, who I love. And so, as you get older and you're a senior, you get frightened and you get intimidated by the medical staff that, they seem to be in a rush. I don't want to hold him up. I'm afraid to ask the question. And so, you learn this in the book, not to be that way. And like you said, have a backup. And a backup is good. Like if the person's in their 60s, 70s, it's good to have someone in their 30s, 40s as a backup because then they will be more forceful. And like you said, ask, how can I look this up on the computer, and to find out more information about what you're saying, whereas a senior wouldn't go that route.
Yeah, it really is a big difference. You really have to have someone who is able to step up and stand up kind of idea. As we age, I'm in my 60s myself, I noticed that a lot of people around me, they're like, oh, he's so busy, I didn't want to bother him, or, oh, no, don't you dare call them, you know, they're too busy, they don't have time for that question. And that mentality, I think, is what really, truly keeps it going. In other words, it's not calling the healthcare on the pad, you know? It's not taking them to task, so to speak. And we just kind of let it go, and we think it's no big deal. You know, I see a lot of death certificates these days, and sometimes I look at them and I go, how did that really happen? Or that doesn't really make much sense to me on there. And we kind of accept it as okay, and we accept it as normal. And we say, oh, that's just the way it is. When truly, there are a lot of things that we can do along the way. Maybe someone is terminally ill. Maybe someone is on the path to dying. However, how they get there is really what's most important to us, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, whenever there is a death due to doctor error, it is never put on the death certificate. And that's why they really have a hard time wrapping their arms around the figure. But these two surgeons from Johns Hopkins did the report on the British Medical Journal that they figured between 250,000 to 400,000 patients are dying each year due to doctor error. And that's how it has become the third largest cause of death in the U.S., cancer, heart disease, and doctor error. And as time goes on, the number is not decreasing. The number is increasing. And throughout medical manslaughter, there's a variety of episodes that shows you that, we need to operate on his gallbladder. Well, that they didn't need to, and they didn't because I stopped it. And other instances, and that would give you examples of if you don't stand up and you don't use, like you said from the beginning, use your intuition. It's your alarm button. It's telling you, hey, this doesn't sound right to me. You want to go in and operate on my loved one, and yet we haven't even received the blood results yet, or we haven't conferred with our doctor who possibly should confer with maybe another doctor, a colleague. And so, this is when your intuition is beeping, hey, stop, put the brakes on this. Because as I said to the neurologist, I said, I don't want my husband to be your guinea pig. Because he was trying this, he was trying that. And then he said, well, I could go in, I could put a balloon in his brain, da-dee-da-da. And I said, no way. He will not be your guinea pig, doctor. And then he said to me, I understand. I respect what you've just said. And so they know better. They know better.
Today we discuss many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit DrJeanetteGallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.
And I think also to the idea of being a consistent eyes of the patient is really important. When you talk about bed sores and items like this throughout your book, again, the book is Medical Manslaughter, when you notice those, I think it is really saying the truth of, it's a very daunting task. It's a very physical, emotional, and stressful job to be able to care for patients 24/7 if you're a family member or if you're a soul survivor, or if you are an advocate and you have no backup. I think the idea that 24/7, you really hope that you can rely on other people like nurses' aides, on RNs, on hospice, and we really hope that they're doing the best for our family members. But don't you think that sometimes you just have to give it over sometimes to others, and you just have to hope that they're doing the best, but also know that you'll be that one that's also watching and doing the caretaking too?
Absolutely. You know, as an advocate, whether the patient is in the hospital, in the nursing home, or even home on hospice, you know, you're there for a reason. You're not there to walk in and put down a bunch of magazines and sit down and eat bonbons and just say, oh, how you right. doing today? And the patient will say, oh, okay. And you say, oh, great. And no. You're there to really surveil the whole situation. You're looking at those bed sheets to see if they're changed and clean. You ask if you got a bed bath that day. If you see that patient is frowning, they're frowning because they're either worried about something or they're in pain or they didn't sleep. And so you question that. What's the matter? You seem like something's bothering you. Oh, nothing. Oh, yeah, something's bothering you. What is it? Come on, we could talk about it. And da-da-da-da-da. So you really get into it. You look to see, is that food tray sitting there? Now, did someone not come in and help feed this patient? Because this patient right. certainly can't get themselves to that food tray. And so has that food been sitting there for a couple of hours at breakfast and now it's already noon? I mean, then you meet with that nurse. Who's the nurse of the day? Who is the main nurse, you know, attending to my husband or my friend, whatever? And you talk with them. You know, how's he doing? How did he sleep last night? You know, what's going on? Is he getting any new medicines? Has the doctor been in? You ask all these pertinent questions because it's a job, like you said. It's a full-time right. job to take care of your loved one, and the bottom line is get them home safe and alive. And that's really the goal, because the medical staff, we're short of nurses, we're short of aides, we're short of doctors. I mean, somebody's got to fill in those gaps, you know?
Yeah. And also, I think, too, the idea is document. If you're there, document time you came, what you saw, what happened, what went on. Even if you're just a family member that's coming in to visit, maybe a loved one could leave a piece of paper by their head and it would say, I was here today, or send a text to someone. I'm at the hospital. What do you want me to find out? What would you like me to check out? And then you have the text as a document. It's truly about being able to be observant, to document, and to ask questions. Those are the three things, yes?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, start a journal from the very day that person goes into the hospital. You put down the day. Each page is a new day. Put down the day, the time, what happened, what doctor you met with, what nurse, what specialist. And you right. think you're going to remember it. You say, oh, I'll remember this incident. No, you will not remember it. And as time goes right. on, the days and that, you'll forget more and more. Like, gee, what was that? Was that on Tuesday that he went in the hospital? And so you do this journal and you start it. Could be, doesn't have to be anything fancy, just a big regular college journal of a notebook. And then when you get their business cards, you staple that in there so you know exactly who is in charge of what. And like I say, you're going to have not only doctors, but you're going to have specialists. You're going to have different people that are coming in to discuss various things that are going on with the patient. And then finally, when the patient comes home, you have all this record of what went on, new medicines that were giving, or trials and tribulations, emergencies that happened. And like my husband fell out of bed. I warned him he was going to fall out of bed because after I brought him out of his coma, which of course they said he would never come out of, and the head neurologist at the hospital said, let him die. Because I said, right. what are we going to do now? And he goes, let him die. He's lived a great life. Let him go. And I said, you know, apparently you've never loved anyone. And he said, yeah, I have loved, but I knew when to let them go. I said, well, I'm not letting go because he's in there fighting. I know him. You don't. And I said, I will bring him out of that coma. He said, I am very doubtful that's going to happen. And so then from that point, they pressure you to leave the hospital. I finally found a nursing home after going to about 10 of them, found one that took him in only because they thought he was going to die in 5 days. And the doctor that admitted him told me that after he met me, after we were already in the nursing home 3 or 4 days, he finally showed up. And that's what he said to me. And I said, well, doctor, I have more faith than you do. I'm going to bring him out of the coma. I will. Mm-hmm. And I said, I swear to God, I will. And he said, well, I'm here every few days. He said, let me know how that's working out. And that was his words to me. And he left. And 34 days later, my husband did wake up. But documentation, like you say, documentation is absolutely necessary from day one.
And to also understand, too, and it's definitely in your story, is that what one physician may say, the other may contradict, the third may decide an order and put it on the chart, and the fourth one may turn around and say no way and stop the process. To believe that everybody is on the same plane is an illusion that I do not know how it got started. I think it came along when everybody thought medical records were on the computer, so everybody would be talking to each other, which is such an illusion also, is that they do not. That does not happen. Truly, each person has their own individual silo treatment therapies and what they're doing, and they stay within that. It's just that a patient is the overlapping, and they don't ever see that. Don't you think you've seen that many times, especially when you talked about the spinal tap in your book?
Exactly. Spinal tap specialist, he comes in and he say, you know, he needs a spinal tap. We should do a spinal tap. He's got an infection in there. We're not exactly sure where it's at in his body, but we should do a spinal tap. But I said, well, gee, that sounds so drastic. Well, yeah, you know, if there's pressure on his brain will flatten like a pancake and he could die instantly. I said, no way. I said, we're not touching him. So he leaves, and the next day back again, spinal tap, he needs it. He's got to have it. Then the next day his assistant comes in. He must have that spinal tap. And so you're getting all this pressure. And like you say, you know, myself, I was standing there alone. All my relatives are in Pennsylvania. My husband's relatives, for the most part, were all deceased. And so, I mean, yeah, did we have a couple friends that I would talk to and, you know, on and off? Definitely. But physically, I stood by that bed by myself every day and had to make these decisions on my own. And so as it worked out was, I said, oh, well, if you really feel he needs it, but I want to be in that room when you're doing it. Oh, no, we can't have that. We never have that. I said, well, then forget it. Well, then next day comes in. Okay, I talked to a doctor. You could come in. You could come in. So before that even happened, in walks the head neurologist with all of his different interns, and we're talking, and he's examining my husband for the first time and asking me what all had transpired. And finally, he's just about done, ready to go. I said to him, well, doctor, I said, what about that spinal tap? And he said, what spinal tap? And I said, the spinal tap that you're supposed to give him today at 4? And he looked at this other doctor, and he said, I don't know anything about it. And he looked at him, and he goes, there will be no spinal tap. And he looked at me, and he said, Mrs. Carcione, he said, a spinal tap would not be good for your husband. And then he looked back at that doctor and he said, again, there will be no spinal tap. Do you understand me? And that doctor said, yes, doctor. Yes, doctor. And so there you have it. How about that?
Right, because you always believe that they each have each other's backs, so to speak. Do you know what I mean? In other words, they know what's going on, and they've each consulted each other, and that they are all on the same track, and that's really not true, right?
Absolutely not. And then, like you say, they have the electronic devices too nowadays that they say it is checking on the patient, the heart rate and everything else like that. But there also has to be someone else at a remote location who is reading what is coming off of that electronics. And if they're not reading it, there's been many patients that have died because they've gone into cardiac arrest and other things have happened. They've been choking or whatever, and nobody's reading what's coming off of that computer. So that certainly wasn't any help at all to have that.
Gloria, can we talk a little bit about the power of prayer? You share that a lot in your book, and I think that's very important because so many times people will say, well, I'm giving up on God. He just didn't do it right, you know? And we say, no, that really isn't the truth. They're doing the best. Everybody's doing the best and using the power of prayer. How did you use it throughout your husband's time?
I am very spiritually connected. I believe in prayer. I talk to Jesus and the Blessed Mother and have a strong bond with them. And when this happened, of course, I prayed, I questioned, you know, I asked for guidance, I asked for strength, and I needed it, and it was the only place I was getting it. You know, sure, like I said, relatives and friends at a distance would call and, you know, console you or say, well, I think this or I think that, and, you know, and that's nice, but there's nothing that replaces prayer, and you have to continue that connection with God or spirit or universe, whatever name you want to put on it, not just when you need help, not just when you find out you're dying of cancer or a loved one is very ill or an accident happens. You have to get that communication and that bond going all the time, and every day be so thankful and so grateful for what you have, because no matter what you have so much more than someone else, and so there's much always to be grateful for. And I couldn't have made it through this whole ordeal of 7 months of a nightmare without the guidance from Jesus and also the Blessed Mother.
Yeah, I think sometimes we tend to say later, and or to sit back and allow God to take over, and then we say, well, it must have been God's way, but we don't participate. In other words, you both are participating in unison for the patient, you know, with God, with prayer, with the healthcare team, with the advocate, with yourself, with family. Everybody's got to be on board. It's truly it's almost like a web of life that has to coincide and work together instead of being torn apart, because those pieces are really so vitally important, yes?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, at one point, like I said, all of a sudden his stomach started to blow up, and they said, well, they thought that it was the gallbladder, and then they thought there was, they tested the gallbladder, rushed him from the nursing home to the hospital, and in testing, tested the gallbladder and said it was very hot. Well, as I know, you can't go in and touch this hot gallbladder, otherwise it's going to explode all over, and that infection will go everywhere instantly, and that'll cause death. And so they just kept testing with blood tests and all, and they were confident on Saturday that they were going to operate early Monday morning. And later on, I found out that even the surgeon said to our doctor, I'm really worried about this operation. I don't think this gentleman will make it through. And the doctor said, oh, man. So everybody was uptight. But prayer got into it. A priest came by, gave, of course, the communion and last rites. And we prayed to the Blessed Mother, and we prayed to Jesus for enlightenment and healing and peace. And always say, thy will be done, not mine. And by Sunday, when they did the final blood test Sunday evening, it came back, the gallbladder was completely healthy, and there was no infection anymore. And so throughout this seven-month ordeal, throughout the story in Medical Manslaughter, the true story, six miracles occurred. Six miracles in 7 months. It's unbelievable, but it's all documented there, and these are all true happenings. And so I even include a prayer in there that was given to me by a Catholic nun when I was in third grade. And it's a prayer to the Blessed Mother that's never found to fail. And it doesn't matter if you're Catholic or not. This prayer works. And that alone is worth the price of the book, I mean to tell you. and so I, of course, prayed this prayer, and I purposely included this prayer in the book because I wanted everyone to have it and everyone to read it. Because the Blessed Mother is there for you. And like I said, doesn't matter your religion background, but she is our Heavenly Mother. And people say to me, well, you know, I don't pray to anyone but Jesus. And so I go straight to Jesus. And all I can say to you is this. As you have a son, a mother and a son, what mother can go to her son and say, you know, son, my dear friend needs your help, or my dear friend needs your healing? Okay, we do that in life all the time. What son says, oh, mother, no, I don't want to hear about it. I don't care about your friend, and walk away. What's the same thing with Jesus? And the Blessed Mother, his mother, goes to him and says, in your name, help, help this person. So she's a good person. He's a good person. He needs healing. Help him. And so Jesus does these things for his mother. So you can't lose out.
Yeah. And it's very important to be able to reach out. I think sometimes when someone is ill or in the hospital, we tend to run sometimes our own tapes. In other words, our fear, our lack of maybe knowing how to ask questions, our lack of knowing anything about health or how to take care of someone, or sometimes our lack of just plain just don't care or responsibility. And, you know, I've even heard people, Gloria, that would say, I'm so thrilled they're in the hospital because I just couldn't deal with it anymore. And they just, like, take you up to the door and they'll leave you there. And I think that we see that a lot with nursing homes, too, these days, how that's been happening, you know. And I think what you and I are really talking about is if you are able to be engaged with helping someone, please do. And if you're not able to, please find someone who can. Don't you think that's the biggest message?
Oh, absolutely. And in the nursing home, as I documented there in Medical Manslaughter, you pass a door and you see a loved one doesn't get a lot of visitors, or just the family comes in on the weekend, and you could hear that patient saying, you know, can I just come home with you? I won't be any bother. I won't ask for anything. I just want to be with you guys. I don't want to be here every day by myself. I just want to be with you. Can't I come home? And the family sometimes doesn't even respond. They just look away like they didn't hear you. And, you know, it's so heartbreaking. It's so tremendously heartbreaking to see that occur, or you see the person like who was in the bed next to my husband for a while. Nobody ever called him. Nobody ever came to visit. And the guy only had one leg and almost just one arm and a half. And he had a speech defect, and, you know, sometimes that tray would come and just be dropped, And I would see this, and then I would wait a while, and then I'd go out front and say, hey, you know, somebody needs to come in and take care of him, feed him. He can't feed himself. Well, you know, we're busy. We're taking patients down the hall to dinner in the dining room. We'll get to him. We'll get to him. And you try to help out, you know what I mean? All of a sudden you're there for your husband, but all of a sudden you're taking care of somebody else too. And right. many a times I ended up changing my husband's bed. I ended up being the one to give him the bed bath, changed, of course, the diapers. And, you know, you think to yourself as you sit there, wonder if I wasn't here. Wonder if I couldn't be here. What would happen to this person, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I think the greatest story, too, Gloria, that we can bring from your book is that is if you have loved ones, you're going to be called on at some point to be able to help them and how you can truly help them. You know, we've come so far from the idea that families are taken care of by family members. Now people are all across the country. They're all in different states. Everybody's got a job to do, that kind of idea. And rarely is there anyone to actually caretake within a family anymore. And we see so many times people say, I don't ever want to get old. And the day that I get old and I'm by myself, I'm checking out. You know, give me the keys to the car and I'll see you later, you know, idea. And because it's just so devastating to think how you can live many more decades of your life with just such a substandard quality of life. I think quality of life is really what we're talking about here, is eating, taking care of, personal hygiene, knowing that everything is okay, doing the right thing. That's truly about quality of life. And we've kind of given up on quality of life because we've really looked at what is the bottom line, who's going to get stuck for what, and how fast can we move them on. You know, nobody ever wants someone more than a few months in the nursing home or a few months in hospice or a few days or weeks in the hospital. It's always let's move them on. And we see this quite often. So I think the idea is how can we be responsible for human beings, and isn't that really our journey?
Yeah. In so many cultures, as you get older, you're respected and put on a
right.
pedestal, but unfortunately mm-hmm. not here. And just because you have children, that is no guarantee that, oh, I got children, so if I get sick, they're going to come visit me and they're going to take care of me.
Yeah. Mm-mm.
There's no guarantees. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand exactly, you know, what you're saying, and it is a fearful situation, especially,
right.
I'll be honest with you, myself. I'm now, of course, you know, don't have my husband. I don't have any children. My family
right.
all lives in another state. I've yeah. got a ton of acquaintances, but I really don't have a lot of friends. And by friends, I mean somebody that you could call up at midnight and say, hey, you know, I'm really having chest pains, or I really need you
right.
here or something. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so actually, I have for some time now have said to Jesus, I would like you to take me home. I said, when I'm 80, I put a number on it. And
yeah.
But people have said to me, what, you've asked for that? Wonder if you meet
right.
someone, and wonder if, you know, this happens. And I said, yeah, it doesn't matter. If I meet someone, that's
yeah.
wonderful. But at 80, I would like to go home. I will have seen enough, experienced enough. I said, now, of course, it's up to God. He may say, you know, no way, you're staying till 100. And then I would say, oh, my God. But
right.
Nevertheless, I have put a number on it because I have seen a lot, and not only just with what happened to my husband, but I've seen it with older friends. And see, my husband was 25 years older than me, and so we associated a lot with a lot of his friends, and they all became seniors all together, type of thing. And you see children that you know, oh, I'm going with my daughter to dinner, and I have such a taste for Italian food. And then you talk to a couple of days later, oh, so where'd you go for the Italian food? Oh, she didn't want Italian. Her and her husband, they wanted Chinese, so we went to Chinese. Oh, well, that's nice. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just little things that said to you, well, I'm going to pick up Dad because it's kind of a thing I should do, but whether he has a good time or not isn't really the main event. And you know, seeing a lot of this, I just, it's upsetting. It's upsetting.
Yeah. Life has certainly changed, I think, Gloria. Pretty much, you know, with this idea of we want to live longer and live longer, and I'll say, heck no. You know,
right.
I don't need any of those anti-aging therapies. You can keep them quite well to yourself, you know.
That's right.
Just,
you know,
I'm just fine how I am today. Right?
Oh, that's true. It's so true. You try desperately to take care of yourself, and you take extra precautions to look where you're stepping so you don't trip, you don't fall, and, you know, because, you know, you're it. That's the only way to put it, is you are it.
Oh. Well, Glory, it was such a pleasure to speak with you today. I think a lot of the things that we brought up is definitely commonplace, especially if you're over the age of 50, you've seen it, you've heard about it, and if you haven't, you've been turning a blind eye. So I think one time you'll just hit your own proverbial personal wall, and then you'll be able to say, oh, now I heard it, don't you think?
Absolutely. So I urge everyone, you know, in order to write Medical Manslaughter, it took me 3.5 years to write it because I had to relive it. And certainly it wasn't an easy story to write. It was a nightmare that naturally leaves you reliving these events. And, of course, you become very emotional. And how many times I've walked away from the computer, sometimes a whole month or two, and then someone would come up to me from out of nowhere and say, hey, how's your book coming along? Did you write that book? Did you finish that book? And it was almost like an angel was sent to me. And I would say, oh, yeah, I'm working on it. Then I would force myself to go back and sit down, reread what I wrote so I knew where to start again, and then keep on going, and then keep on going, and keep on going. And finally, it got produced. And during that time, there was quite a few metaphysical things that happened, Dr. Jeanette, that was almost like the devil not wanting this book to be printed, because naturally it has a strong emphasis towards Jesus and the angels and the archangels and the Blessed Mother. And I give them a lot of thankfulness and gratitude right there in the book. And it was, you know, clocks falling off the wall, the Blessed Mother's picture fell off the wall, and yet the hanger was still on the wall. And so you're thinking, well, how'd that happen, and why did that happen? And there was even a hurricane that occurred during the production, because it was produced in the Philippines, even though the company I hired, Author House, is located in Indiana. I did not know that the production and all was going to be done in the Philippines, but they had a hurricane and all, and it was like, is this book ever going to get done? You know, it was like pulling teeth, you know. So finally, it did. But a lot of spiritual influence there.
Yes. And I think that's very important, is to be awakened to that. Can you share, Gloria, with the listeners how to find out more information about you and about the book? That would be wonderful.
Sure. My website is Gloria J. York, and York is Y-O-R-K-E. Always include my middle initial J. So GloriaJYork.us. That's my website. You can read all about the book and the highlights of the book, and of course about myself, and you could order the book right there, or it is available on Amazon and also Barnes and Noble. It's gotten 5-star reviews from everyone that has read it and has given reviews. So it is a number one bestseller, and I promise you, when you finish reading it, you'll be more enlightened, you're more stronger, you'll be more knowledgeable, and it'll help you to save your life. It really will.
I think it's very important. If you're over the age of 50, grab the book. Period. You don't even need to give you any ifs, ands, or buts. Just get it and be able to say, "Oh dear." And then when you start to say, "Oh dear," then you can start to formulate your own plan, right?
That's right. It's medical manslaughter.
Yes. Well, Gloria, thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a pleasure to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Jannetty. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much. If you'd like to find out more information about Gloria York, the book again is Medical Manslaughter, based on a true story, Will Your Doctor Cause Your Death? Please do click on the link on the bottom of today's show page, and you'll go directly to the website to find out more information and also the link for the Amazon book. And it truly is about being able to say, are we safe wherever we are taken for healthcare? And do we just drop them off at the door and walk away? I don't think so. It's truly about being engaged in every step of your health and your life, and also to be able to have someone as a backup. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Dr. Jannette Gallagher. Till tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jannette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjannettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.